Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Modern science and scientists seem more united than ever that climate change, global warming, is a fact that cannot reasonably be denied. In fact, in a report coming out this week, an international scientific panel will issue what is called the starkest warning yet about climate change. Temperatures have been on the rise since the Industrial Revolution. Projections are that those increases will soar over the next century, producing more extreme weather, a dangerous rise in sea levels, damage to our health and ecosystem. Climate change deniers say the case is overstated, that temperature fluctuation is cyclic, that scientists are playing with numbers in their own self-interest. There are some indications that the number of these deniers is on the rise. I'm Don Marsh, here to discuss climate change. Dr. David Titley, senior scientist at the Department of Meteorology and director at the Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk at Penn State University. He's a former Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy, where much of his work centered on meteorology and oceanography. He joins us by phone from the university. Professor Kara Krakos is Assistant Professor of Biology at Maryville University and a Research Associate at the Missouri Botanical Garden. Her research focus is on the impact of climate change on plants. They will be appearing at an event at Maryville University next week, and I'll have more on that later. Thank you both so much for being here, Kara. And Dr. Titley, nice to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Don, for having me.
Excited to be here.
Do you mind if I call you Dave?
Please do.
All right, Dave. Let me begin with you and ask you how you might explain the stark warning from the International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, which is expected out later this week, and some numbers showing that the number of doubters, deniers, if you will, seems to be on the increase.
Well, thanks, Don. I mean, there's a number of parts there that are pretty interesting, but I think the real basic thing that comes out of at least what I've seen of the new report that as you mentioned will be due out on Friday, but it's been pretty widely leaked, is the scientific community is even more convinced that the climate is changing because of what we as people are doing, and by adding the greenhouse gases, basically traps the heat in the lower part of the atmosphere. That heat goes into the atmosphere. A lot of the heat goes into the ocean. And this is basically like you keep putting stuff in, but you don't take stuff out. So we're keeping the heat. So you would expect something to change. And what the change is it's warming. I think you see the number of people who, you know, and I really dislike the term believe. I mean, this isn't theology. It's mm-hmm. kind of science. So I would say are either convinced or not convinced by the evidence. Tends to go up and down almost with, like, what the weather of the last, you know, few weeks was. And the climate is a much, much longer time scale, so you got to look at least a few decades, and that's hard. You know, I mean, our lifespans are, you know, 70, 80, 90 years, so we're just this blink of an eye. So it's hard. It's hard for us to think about that. We see if we have a warm winter, we say, oh, geez, you know, the climate's changing. If we have a cold and snowy winter, it's like, the climate's fine, you know, everything is good. We have a drought, a huge drought last year out in the Midwest. People get worried. The rains come back. It's not so much. So those are all parts of this. But, you know, but kind of you just strip it down to kind of the bare essentials. And we've known, the science community has known since about the middle of the 19th century, like since about the 1850s, 1860s, that carbon dioxide actually keeps heat in the atmosphere. It keeps heat in the air there. And you can look at air temperatures, ocean temperatures. You watch what the ecosystems are doing. You look at the glaciers. You look at the ice in the Arctic. You look at the sea level. And maybe you could argue with any one of those individual data sets, but it takes a really, really hard to understand explanation to kind of explain away all of that change at one time.
Just one other question about the IPCC. Again, that report coming out later this week. But mm-hmm. has this organization been tainted at all by the revelation a couple of years ago that some of the numbers that scientists there came up with were inaccurate?
Well, actually, the numbers that the scientists came up with were not inaccurate. They were accurate. And what came out of that, as you probably know, is many of the nation's individual science academies basically did their own investigation, and then the UN did a further investigation. And every one of those investigations actually said, you know, they pulled some individual emails, and how those were hacked illegally is a matter for maybe for another day. But they pulled those individual emails, and they were basically like just snippets of conversations, which some folks then basically took a few phrases out of context, put them together, and tried to make a big story out of it. It was very interesting that, you know, when I was looking at how that was being portrayed, is you could see some folks then who had other people's emails hacked. They ended up with the same thing. You would end up with people saying, well, geez, that was taken out of context, and you shouldn't have done that. And these were folks, like, it happened to be on the far right. They did not appreciate their emails being hacked any more than the scientists who worked this. So I think I'd push back a little bit there, Don, in saying that the numbers were incorrect in the so-called ClimateGate emails. Now, there were a couple of minor issues, like there was a Himalaya ice thing, which, you know, again, 1,300-page report. They basically transposed a couple of digits. But again, I think the thing to sit here is you basically have this consensus of about 97% of the world's climate and atmospheric scientists that says, hey, guys, this is a big deal, and we need to pay attention.
Garrett Krakus, do you see this as having been damaging at all to the cause of people trying to convince the world that climate change is really happening when you have an incident such as the IPCC email incident?
So actually, I think it's interesting because, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. It raised awareness to some degree. It certainly had the interesting part where people always love to see messy humans in action. And certainly emails fired back and forth between colleagues can be quite raw and not ready for publication. And peeling back that curtain a little bit on science led to a big fuss, but it was also that brought a lot of attention and focus to, well, let's really crunch the numbers and be certain. And as David said, that was very solid outcome for the evidence. So despite the messy human aspect, it stood up and it raised a higher awareness. So I actually think it had a net positive effect.
How are your students reacting to the whole climate change issue? How are you, I guess I'm asking how young people are approaching it.
Yes. So I teach at a undergraduate institution. So my students are primarily between the ages of 18 and 22, the millennials. As we talk about, they are very different as a generation. And what's really interesting to me is how much of them don't see many of the so-called controversies in science as controversies at all. They are very conscientious and aware of the needs of the planet. They're very proactive about recycling and the need for sustainability efforts. We had a Maryville Reaches Out Service Day last week, and we had over 1,000 volunteers from the students, 18-year-olds, out in the community and locally, and many of these were green projects and so forth. And I thought, my goodness, that's quite a character test for young people. I don't have that many students in the classroom who push back, and believe me, this generation will cheerfully push back, saying, well, that's rubbish, and I don't believe that. They don't do that often. Now, you always get those that do, but mostly, once you put the evidence in front of them, they move forward with it. It's a different generation.
Dave, you finding the same thing at Pennsylvania?
Yeah, at Penn State here, we have one of the largest undergraduate meteorology programs in the country. So it's interesting. We train a lot of students here. They go off to, you know, be on the local, you know, evening news television stations. And some of your listeners, may have heard of, you know, geez, the TV guys don't always understand what the climate guys are saying. I think here we have made a real effort to make sure that when when an undergraduate leaves with a degree in meteorology, that he or she also has a pretty good understanding of the basic workings of climate. Again, that climate is that long-term balance between sort of heat coming in and heat going out, and how that that changes the big picture, if you will. Whereas the weather is, you know, kind of what I call the pointy end of climate. It's what we live in day to day. And what we have found is it's important for the students to understand that while there is, as we all know, tremendous daily variability or weekly variability in the weather, that you can take that out, you can average it out over time, and you can see the trends, whether the trends are up or down or drier or colder. And it's important to sort of understand the daily variability does not mean that we can't see long-term trends. And I think the vast majority of the students graduating from here and in the junior, senior, sophomore levels understand that. And I think it's an important part that the faculty is trying to make sure that the students do, so that they can, frankly, tackle what's going to be one of the most important issues of their lives.
What has the temperature change been in the last 150 years? And what is it projected to be 100 years from now?
Well, the temperature has gone up, and correct me if I get the exact numbers wrong here, Kara, but it's been a little over a degree Fahrenheit for the globe as a whole. I think it's, 1.4, if I'm not mistaken, let's say since the mid-1800s or start of the Industrial Revolution. So let's say a degree and a half, which certainly doesn't sound like a whole lot, does it? But that's not evenly distributed, so it's gone up more over the land than it has over the ocean, and it's gone up a lot more over the poles and especially the Arctic than it has over the mid levels. So when you look at that, and then you start saying, well, geez, where are we going? We're probably going to another in degree Fahrenheit. Let's say for the next 150 years, it really depends on what we do with our behavior, but probably somewhere between 1.5 and 3.5, maybe 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So we've just started on this road, which is kind of a scary thought, because we're already starting to see, the changes in the precipitation patterns. We're seeing big, big changes in the Arctic. We're seeing the sea levels come up. And unless we really change how much carbon we're putting into the atmosphere, we're going to think that 2013 are the good old days here.
Well, we want to come back and talk more about the impact of all of this in just a moment, and we'll do that. My guests are Dr. David Titley. He joins us from the University of Pennsylvania. With me in studio is Kara Krakus from Maryville University. She's a biologist, teaches biology. We'll come back and talk about the impact of climate change, and we'll be taking your calls, too. Where do you stand on this issue, and why? On climate change. Our number, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back to our discussion about climate change. With me in studio is Kara Krakus of Maryville University. Joining us by phone from the University of Pennsylvania is Dr. David Titley. Kara, let me start with you in this segment. We've heard about the temperature increase over the last century and a half and what is projected. Actually, I've heard Dr. Titley mentioned maybe up to 3.5 degrees, something like that.
Somewhere between 2 and 5.
Yeah, and I've heard even more than that, but who knows where that's coming from. What has this done, from your point of view as a biologist, what has this done to the planet most recently, let's say, and what is it projected to do if it continues?
So my particular area of expertise is in plant phenology and plant-pollinator interactions. So I look at sort of how the climate change impacts at much more microclimate levels, at local habitats, which might not sound nearly as exciting as large sheets of ice breaking off and the oceans rising.
But it does affect agriculture.
But it affects what we eat. It affects our food supply. It affects our economics. And particularly our little pollinators, turn out to be tremendously important and quite impactful, especially in the area of agriculture. Over 80% of our plants rely on pollinators to set seed, and we are not capable of handling that workload as they do. And so one of the concerns with climate change is that even small shifts in weather patterns and in climate can really impact where plants are, where they grow, how widespread they are, and then how long they grow for. And you might be, well, so for instance, we've seen in the last 15 years a shift in even by just a couple weeks of species that bloom longer. And the reason that might be a problem is that now you have plants and pollinators that are interacting that have never interacted before. They're competing for pollinators, or they're being out-competed in general for space. And all of those things uncouple those interactions and disrupt the dynamics of what we have based our ecosystem decisions on, not just what you decide to plant in your garden, but on big agricultural decisions. And that can be that is a very large concern.
So while a lot of people are wondering about the future of the polar bear, really what you've just described here is something we really ought to be concerned about.
The future of the honeybee and the bumblebees, yeah.
Is the diminishing population of the honeybee, is that something you could attribute to climate change?
So colony collapse disorder
exactly.
is what was in the news quite a bit with the honeybees. And that was something that came out of those years was that we saw that as the honeybees declined, there was an uptick over a few years in the number of native pollinators. They came back in rather large numbers and with more diversity. And now there's a great effort and push to make sure that we keep that diversity of our native pollinators because diversity is safety. You mm-hmm. rely on one type of thing for any kind of area, and you're in trouble. But the native bees picked up the slack, if you will, in quite an impressive way. And so conservation efforts have really been focused in that area. The impact of climate change directly on honeybees, not something that I could draw a direct line to.
Sure.
However, the way that the pollinators react to more or less plants flowering at the same time or invasive species being present where they weren't before is due to climate change. And we are just starting to collect data on some of those interactions.
Well, they all have biological clocks just as we do.
They do.
And that would impact.
Yes. If you come out and your flower's gone, yeah. That's bad news.
Yeah. Dr. Titley, this is most fascinating, I think, but it's not something I hear a lot of people talking about. I mentioned the polar bears on ice cubes, and that's and some of the other things we're talking about, small islands in the Pacific and elsewhere, and even our own coasts being endangered by all of this. Give us some sense of the things that could happen beyond agriculture and biology.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Thanks, Don. And I'm really glad to hear Kara talk about that. And many times when I talk about climate change, the first thing I tell people is this is really about people. It's not about polar bears. With all due respect to the polar bears, and I love polar bears as much as the next person, but let's face it, if polar bears were the only thing threatened by climate change, do you really think we would seriously consider about revamping the world's entire energy infrastructure? You know, I don't think we would, but it's not about polar bears, as Kara so eloquently stated. It's really about food. It's about water. It's about energy, and really that means it's about people. It's about you and me. It's about our families. It's about our children. It's about our neighbors. That's who climate change is going to affect. It's like, yeah, the polar bears, it may be tough for them, but it's going to be tough for us, especially if we are having a hard time with the climate. Kara, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think rice stops flowering once it gets too warm. I think it's about, in Fahrenheit, I don't know, about 90 or 91 degrees.
Plant phenology is, we have a lot of evidence, a lot of really good studies in the last 6 years that very much show that the impact on plant phenology, and I should define that for ice fest.
Yeah.
Plant phenology is how long or the cycles of flowering for a plant, how long or how often. And so those were the first studies that were done before we even started looking at interactions. And the shifts by even a few weeks are pretty devastating for harvests and things like that.
So the issue is, okay, it gets a little warmer, it doesn't cool down as much at night, and people say, well, okay, I'll run my air conditioner a little bit more. Maybe, but if we cannot get our, you know, basic food crops, and not only in the U.S., but really in the world, in Asia, in Europe, to germinate or germinate at anything like the productivity, as we're supporting a world of over 7 billion people, that's going to lead to a lot of stress, and that stress could play out as some pretty nasty conflicts there. So this this concept of, you know, as the water changes, as it heats up, how does that impact on agriculture? And of course, you know, agriculture science has done wonderful things in the last few decades. We do still, by and large, feed the world. But I think it's a very open question now, if you start changing the climate, can the genetic modification, can the advances in agriculture science, frankly, keep up with how the climate is going to change? And, you know, if we start running that experiment, there's no control. There's no, like, well, let's just reset it and go back to where we were in the year 2000. So that's a pretty serious thing to be doing with, you know, the lives of, you know, billions of people.
Well, and an important point, I think, is that all of our extrapolations and predictions, I mean, that's assuming the emission rate holds steady, which it's not.
It's going up.
Yes.
Are fossil fuels the single biggest culprit in all of this?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That was an easy one.
That's the easiest question we've had all day. Yes, they are. Coal is a huge amount of that. When you look at the amount of fossil fuels on the earth or in the earth, coal is the vast proportion of this, along with, of course, significant natural gas and oil. But yes, this is basically, we're taking all the carbon that is being, you know, buried in the ground, and we're putting it into the atmosphere in a period of centuries. And so we've basically taken processes that took hundreds of thousands and millions of years naturally to move this carbon between the atmosphere and the earth, below the surface of the earth. And we're putting it into the atmosphere, you know, geologically, just in the snap of a finger, a blink of an eye, whatever phrase you'd like to use. And then we're going to sort of see what happens to the how the earth responds. That's what we're just beginning to live through right now.
How much would we have to reduce these emissions in order to stabilize, if that's the correct word, stabilize the situation?
Well, the IPCC, or the UN basically meeting of all the world's climate experts, basically says that we need to keep to a budget of no more than about 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide, or technically carbon dioxide equivalent, but let's just call it 450. Right now we passed, as probably many of your listeners knew, just a few months ago, we got to the 400 mark. When I started looking at this, we were at about 370, and that was, you know, not all that long ago. There's actually a non-governmental organization called 350.org. It almost seems quaint now that, you know, somebody wanted to hold the level of carbon dioxide at 350 parts per million. So what all that, you know, a lot of numbers, what does that mean? That means that we don't really have a lot of time to try to hold the amount of carbon we put into the atmosphere to a level where we think the impacts could be manageable. And that's kind of what it is, you know, can you deal with this stuff? And I think most people would argue that if you could magically snap your hand and say, okay, nothing more than what we have today, you know, can we deal with it? Yeah, we probably could. But this is one of those problems that, you know, you don't get to just snap your fingers and say, okay, this is enough and we're done now. As I said, 2013 will start to look like the good old days, and that's the challenge.
And Kara, we seem to be moving so slowly on the development of alternative sources. A lot of talk about it, but progress seems to be very, very slow in terms of making it the impetus that's needed to get it to where it should be.
Well, we have such tremendous research happening in solar and wind and geothermal, et cetera. But we are hindered, I think, by the fact that we, at least here in the United States, we have a 2-year political cycle that has no way of dealing with biological realities. Mm-hmm. And the way humans operate under that system kind of is very hindering to us moving forward.
When constituents start to complain about the high cost of food because of what we've been talking about here.
High cost of anything.
High cost of anything. That might change things. Lots to talk about, but we have a lot of folks who want to get into the conversation. Let's start that part of the process right now and begin with Dave, who's calling from St. Charles. Thanks for waiting, Dave. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for letting me have a couple comments.
Sure.
I suppose the first one, which I'll want to comment before we get to it, but the broader comment somebody asked years ago, and I've never heard a good answer for, is what is optimum temperature? I mean, the world does change, differences in plant growth and ocean absorbing. We've seen in the last 10 years that temperature hasn't gone up, and now the ice cap seems to be reforming. So the talk about my concern, I guess, I don't doubt that there's been some increase in temperatures. How much is attributable to man? I don't know. But it's more of my concern is more that there seems to be a exaggerated appeal that we need to be spending 10 or 20% of our GDP to combat this threat to the future of humankind when we have other urgent matters like taking care of healthcare and everything else. And since we don't know what the optimum temperature should be, and since there are in desperate situations, ways to reduce global warming by putting, imitating a volcano and putting sulfur or other things in there. You know, I just don't think we should be putting 10 or 20%. We should be committing our nations to putting so much resources into combating this compared to many other things, feeding the poor, healthcare, other things competing for our dollars.
Dave, we have the point. Let's get a response, and I'll start with you, Dave.
Okay. Well, thanks for the comment. I would say, when man is trying to set the optimum temperature, that's probably a pretty dangerous thing because different people are going to have different optimums. So, how you do that? 10 to 20% seems awful high. I think you can do an awful lot with 1 to 2%. The caller sounded very, very concerned about health care and feeding the poor, and I think those are great, great issues. When you take a look at what climate change does and what the sea level rise and the inundation does, I mean, one of the things the sea level coming into places where people live is not only ultimately does it chase them out, but it takes their fresh water and it makes it salty. You basically get saltwater intrusion into the aquifers. So providing fresh, clean drinking water to people, providing adequate food, and we've just talked extensively about the stresses on agriculture. The people who are going to suffer the most on this are frankly not you and me and people who have economic means. It's going to be the poor people. It's going to be the poor people in Africa. It's going to be people with modest means in Asia, Pacific Islands. They are going to suffer a lot. People down in South Florida are gonna suffer a lot. To think that geoengineering is that, well, we can just put some basically simulate volcanoes. Yes, you can cool the temperature down. When you start doing that, though, you have now committed to doing that for thousands and thousands of years. And there are very, very few things that humans have actually started and continue to do for thousands and thousands of years. Because at some point, if you do that, if you stop it, one of the things everybody agrees is that then the temperature shoots up by many degrees. The other thing, when you do the putting particles up into the atmosphere, is you significantly change and probably reduce the amount of total rainfall. Mount Pinatubo, which is a very big volcano in the Philippines in the early 1990s, that certainly cooled the atmosphere for a couple years. The other thing that we saw was we also had the driest years on record after that. So, yes, you can cool the temperatures, but if you dry everything out and now you don't have rainfall for your crops, now what do you do? Now how do you fix that? So I would argue that reasonable amounts of resources being spent on fixing this problem will, in fact, address many of the issues that your caller raised.
Kara, committing to thousands of years and two-year cycles doesn't sound very practical, does it?
No, it doesn't. But I do like that Dave brought up, Dave from St. Charles, I should say,
yes.
Our caller, that brought home the point that his concern, which I think is the central piece, is that his concern is about people and that it be that our focus be on human concerns, poverty, quality of life, health. I really like that he emphasized that point. And I do think, though, that climate change is about human health. As Dave, our friend from Penn State, this is a little confusing, said, it's about fresh water. It's about the impact on people in poverty. I know when they had the hurricanes down in Haiti, as you know, an example of erratic weather patterns increasing, the cholera outbreaks that happened immediately afterwards were a huge problem with human health. And these sort of domino effects happen with climate change. And I'm also glad that, Dave, you mentioned a question about the ice caps growing. And I wanted to just kind of bring a point up on that. It's true. There was more Arctic sea ice last year, but the year before we had a record-breaking loss. And it kind of actually emphasizes why we need long-term data, that that variation from year to year isn't enough to let us know what we're actually facing.
Yep. Before you respond, if you want to that, Dave, I have to take another break. And I need to apologize to you, too, because I identified you as being from the University of Pennsylvania. Oh, boy, was that a mistake? It's actually Penn State, so I apologize for that. That is my mistake. We're talking to Dr. David Titley from Penn State University and also with Kara Krakus of Maryville University. We're talking about climate change, and we want to advise folks that Town and Country Green Speakers Series in Maryville University present a discussion on climate change and the documentary film Earth, the Operator's Manual. That'll be on Thursday, October 3rd, 2013. At 7 p.m. at Maryville University's Booter Commons. Both of our guests on today's program will be participating in that. Dave will be appearing via Skype, but Carol will be there in the flesh, as it were. Anyway, that's happening on October 3rd at 7 o'clock at Maryville University's Booter Commons. Back to take more of your calls, and we have plenty of them, in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on climate change. My guests in studio are Kara Krakus. That is Dr. Kara Krakus, by the way, PhD from Maryville University, and Dr. David Titley from Penn State University. Before we continue our conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom folks are following today. A St. Louis City Board holds a public hearing this afternoon to consider revoking a permit for the New Life Evangelistic Center. The homeless center's director is Reverend Larry Rice. South Korean officials have rejected Boeing's bid to build and supply 60 new fighter jets. The F-15 is produced in St. Louis though it is unclear how the rejection will impact hundreds of workers at St. Louis's Boeing plant. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Let's go right to the phones. As I say, we have a number of people who want to get into the conversation. We'll be joined now by David in Bourbon, Missouri. Go ahead, David.
Wow, it really is Dave Day on the radio.
Okay. Yes, it is. This is to confuse everyone.
Yep. The guest made a reference early on to some of their students who pushed back regarding the whole business of climate change. And as a longtime resident of rural Missouri, I'm accustomed to that. People I know, local newspapers, et cetera. So does it come down to politics and or religion with your students, or are they making, you know, sort of credible arguments? What kind of position do they come from? All right, thank you.
Carol, let's start with you.
Certainly. Well, first I think you have to understand the demography of our student body is often from rural Missouri. And that actually is a huge strength in the sense that they have very good ecological sense. They have spent a lot of time outdoors. They come from farms. They very much understand the interactions between people and their environment. The pushback is minimal in that they are undergraduates, and so there's not they're not nearly as hostile as graduate students are. But you do have, I would say, you asked if it's between politics or religion, and I would say it's not that defined for their youth. It's more the maybe the culture that they're coming from or their home life discussions. At 18, it's not very clear that they have a full developed political philosophy. Many of them are exploring for the first time where they stand on the faith they were raised in. And, you know, college is sort of that time for exploring all of those areas. And while they're in that flux, their demand is not so much you're wrong, but rather I need more information, which is exactly what I as an educator love to hear. And so, you know, I give them all the data that I can and try to develop those critical thinking skills. But I don't see a clear divide that it comes directly from either politics or religion.
And Dave?
Yeah. Thanks there, Don. Yes, this really is becoming the Dave and Dave show here. Your caller, Dave the caller, brings up, I think, something that to me has just been fascinating. And a gentleman named Dan Kahan out of Yale University has really spent his career trying to understand sort of how much one's political or, you know, sort of world beliefs, if you will, can influence, you know, these very contentious issues. And it's not just climate change. It's like, does tobacco cause cancer for smoking and things like that? And what Dan has found is that the more education you have and the stronger your political belief, the more you will go and find data that convinces you that your personal view is correct. So if you it was really interesting because, you know, we as scientists would like to think it's like, well, geez, if I can just give people the data, the information, everybody, you know, it becomes obvious. So we think. And what Dan has shown in his pretty convincing research is all you will do is sometimes just harden positions. So it's a real conundrum, and I'm not sure that he has a great solution to that, but just the insight is very, very interesting as to how to talk to people. What I try to do is to the degree you can, is to, like, try to take the emotion out. I was a navigator on a Navy destroyer way back when, and a few of your listeners will remember the days before Global Positioning System. So you had to kind of look at all the data when you were a navigator like that. You didn't just press a button and it would tell you where you were. And that's kind of how I look at climate change, is if you look at all the data, it gives you a pretty good indication that the climate is changing and it's changing pretty quickly. And then if you ask yourself why, you take a look at things like, well, look at the sun. And it turns out the sun isn't changing. So you sort of start knocking things out that could cause this, and you come down to, well, we've known for 150 years that if we add greenhouse gases, that keeps heat in. And, you know, all these different types of data show that. So does it convince everybody? No, but it's it helps people get there. And Kara's right, you know, when you talk to undergraduates especially, they're not as maybe hard and fast in their views. And they're looking to explore and looking to understand. And it's a great position to be in as an educator.
Dr. Kara, you wanted to follow up?
I did. One of my favorite things in a classroom to do, you say, how do you get people to understand the data? Dave, like you, if only just putting the data in front of people was sufficient, without, you know, that it would speak for itself. But I found that most humans on the planet of all ages don't like the here's how it is and that's, you know, not open for discussion kind of learning. I found that it's actually much more powerful to sort of present a question without the emotion, but, you know, something for them to hunt down and chew on in climate change. And then the focus of the exercise becomes guiding them and teaching them on how to track down correct data sources. The web is just full of information, full of it. But how do you know if it's just some guy's blog or if you're looking at actual data? And I found that that skill is the one that I'm most concerned about them developing. We can't address every question in a classroom, but hopefully we can teach them how to hunt down good answers.
All right, back to the phones. Ben joins us from Shiloh, Illinois. He's been waiting a long time. We're grateful for that, Ben. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I'm actually a former active duty military officer. I just left this year. And when we were discussing the real-time national security and future national security and geopolitical effects of climate change, such as water shortages and the opening of polar ocean routes, it was often a challenging discussion item because the audience couldn't get past what they saw in a political campaign or heard on talk radio, that it was a myth or a conspiracy and we shouldn't worry about it. I even saw occasional opposition to energy efficiency measures such as turning the lights off at night in buildings or offering fuel-efficient transportation for our troops because people linked that to climate change and therefore to politics and put up a wall. And I was wondering, how did this become such a stubborn an unmoving political issue for so many people? Because as a military officer, it was very challenging when you're trying to warn people and they can't get past the very first opposition in their mind.
Well, Dave, as a former military man, why don't you start?
Well, Ben, first, I want to thank you for your service, sir. I very much appreciate what you have done for our country. It is really fascinating. I'm sure we don't have enough time to go through this the whole, you know, for the rest of the time here. But I think it was not too many weeks ago there was an op-ed, I think in the New York Times, signed by four prominent Republicans, Bill Buckleshaus and three others. I just can't remember their names right now. But today, I'm not even sure they would be sort of welcome into the Republican Party. So this used not to be, until maybe 10 or 15 years ago, it was not an issue that particularly split along party lines. But we've got to where we've got here, and at some point, my guess is that will change. I don't know if it's going to take a discrete big storm or whether just the winds of politics change. I spend a lot of time in Washington, and I think, you know, the politics could shift, and potentially they could shift maybe faster than most people think, but they certainly haven't done that yet. So it is frustrating, and you know that's why, like Ben, you try to think of this really in just sort of in national security terms, in food security, like Kara has talked about. You know, I would personally believe that people of just about every political persuasion in our country, they want us to be safe. They want healthy, clean drinking water. They want adequate food supplies. They want adequate health care. They don't want to be living in unduly dangerous environments. I mean, I personally don't see those as political issues. So we have a common problem here, a common challenge. And we need to face it as a country. And we've done this before. And I'll look at when we decided to go to the moon because we were behind the Soviets at that point. We put our minds to it, and we did it. So we can do this. But it's just a matter of, you know, we're not there yet. But we're going to get there. I'm personally convinced we're going to get there. We may not get there quickly, but we're going to get there.
And, Kara, did you want to elaborate on that at all, or are you in sync with Dave?
I agree with him definitely that, like him, I don't understand how science became a wedge issue in politics. I find that very strange, but such as it is.
But science is a second-class citizen in this country anyway. I mean, still look at the debate over the STEM courses and how poorly our students do overall compared to other industrialized nations.
Yes. And I think that's an entire other hour.
Well, and we've done hours on that, quite frankly.
Yeah. But I do think that there is common ground to build on. Everyone wants to be safe. Everyone wants to be healthy. But I also appreciate that Dave, like myself, I think a lot of scientists, we are optimistic. I am optimistic about what humans are capable of.
On this subject, we have an email from meteorologist Mike Roberts from over at Channel 5 KSDK, who says we need to move past the debate about whether this is happening, because it is, to examine the realistic potential consequences in order to better be prepared for them. I think that's what we're all coming to the conclusion to here today. Back to the phones. Let's bring in Jay calling from Normandy.
Yes, hi, guys. Last night at the St. Louis Zoo, they had a great program. They had a wildlife biologist who talked about the polar bear and the plight of the polar bear and how the Arctic sea ice is melting and the ring seals that the polar bear basically feeds on are there in trouble. Their populations are starting to go down. And, you know, without Arctic sea ice, polar bears, one, won't have their food source, and two, they'll drown because they can't swim forever. So, you know, that's just one other indicator of what's going on in this world. I'm looking at the new National Geographic in front of me, September edition, and the headline on the cover is Rising Seas, How They're Changing Our Coastline. I'm also looking at Science Magazine from August 2, and there about six articles in that magazine are about climate change, and yet I have a friend that wants to argue about it, sends me lists of skeptics of names, and I tell them, what's the point of this? You know, all the national academies, the AGU, the concerned scientists, all of those organizations, and NOAA and NASA all believe it's a problem, but yet I have these skeptic friends that are very frustrating and hard to deal with. But thank you, guys.
Well, thanks very much for the call. I think that's ground, Jay, that we've pretty much covered, and I believe my guests in studio are very much in agreement with what you said. I say that because I want to bring in one more phone call, as time allows, from Jerry in O'Fallon, because he has a point I think that should be made. Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, good morning. I was just going to repeat the quote by Upton Sinclair that it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it. And almost virtually all of these skeptics seem to have some economic ties with industries or that are essentially the villains, if you want to put it that way, in climate change. And I often reflect on the fact that, you know, 100 years ago, a sort of energy source was very popular in the United States and the world. And the alternatives were expensive and unreliable. And had the ice industry, which of course delivered ice to everyone's home, huge infrastructure, had the same political pull that I think the energy industries, at least the entrenched ones, do, we'd probably still have ice delivered to our homes, maybe not by horse, but we'd be stuck with the same thing. And I think, unfortunately, and it's not a political issue, but the only way that we seem to be able to handle it is through the political process.
Jerry, let me stop you there, and I'm sorry to do so, but time is getting away. I want to give our guests a chance to respond to your comment there with regarding the commercial interests. And Kara, we'll start with you. You agree with that?
Definitely. But I think there's another aspect of that in terms of why people become or the way they interact with the Earth. And part of that is that for a long time in human history, there was a philosophy, if you will, of domination of the Earth. And that simply won't do. We need to move far more to a stewardship and caring for the Earth and working with it and being part of that ecosystem rather than viewing ourselves as in charge of it.
A minute left. And Dave, let me turn to you with regard to that comment concerning the commercial interests being amongst the most vocal deniers.
Well, sure. And what I would just say is that certainly not all commercial interests are like that, but some are. And there is a book called Merchants of Doubt by Naomi Oreskes. She writes about this subject that Jerry brought up very, very eloquently. And yes, you can trace a few number of people that the same ones that were saying tobacco was fine and then there was no ozone hole and acid rain wasn't going to be an issue. They're now the ones working on telling us that climate change is not an issue either. So that that is a reality, and it's just one of the challenges that we're going to have to overcome here.
We're going to have to leave it at that. I'm afraid this has been a very fast hour and a very informative one, I think. I want to thank Dr. David Titley of Penn State University for being with us. Thank you so much, Dave. It was great to have you.
Thanks very much.
Among the many Daves we had here today. And Dr. Kara Krakus of Maryville University, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'll just remind our audience, the two of these folks will be together via Skype and in person at Maryville University next Thursday, October 3rd at 7 o'clock at Maryville University's Booter Commons. They'll be talking about what else? Climate change. Again, thank you both so much for being with us. Thank you all for being with us, and hope you're with us tomorrow as well. We'll be talking with Kansas Governor Sam Brownback. In advance of his appearance at the Conservative Political Action Committee, CPAC is in St. Louis this weekend. We'll also hear about a new community initiative which crowdsources proposals for local initiatives. And looking ahead to Thursday, we'll convene our monthly legal roundtable in the courtroom at the new St. Louis University Law School downtown. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.